Hello and welcome back to CoronaCast. I'm Hannah Harris.
And I'm Tilly.
And I'm a London GP, and Tilly's my actor daughter. And we've been making this podcast since early March when coronavirus really took hold in the UK. It's about all things corona. So some health advice from me, some interviews with experts, and also about people's stories and experiences. First, my disclaimer, I'm a GP. I'm not an infectious diseases or public health expert. Opinions expressed are my own and not on behalf of an organisation.
Yeah. In this episode, we are very excited about our guest. We are speaking to Professor Anthony Costello, who is a member of the Independent SAGE Committee.
He's an eminent global health expert, and we talk about all things coronavirus with him, the issues that have been seen in terms of the government's handling of the crisis, testing, the whole timeline and what's happened when and where things kind of might have gone wrong. He also has strong opinions about immunity, whether there might be a second wave. It's really, really fascinating.
Yeah, it's a really informative discussion and we really hope you enjoy it.
With Professor Costello, we also talked about the disproportionate number of Black, Asian and minority ethnic people infected and who have died because of coronavirus. And on the basis of that, we wanted to talk about Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, because it's such a huge issue at the moment that's kind of circulating everywhere in the media and on lots of social media and things like that.
And it's something that we feel really strongly about. So we just wanted to say how important we feel the issue is. As two white women, it has been really heart-rending to read the experiences of our friends and other people on social media and in the press in the last couple of weeks.
It's also been so eye-opening and how much work there needs to be done, how much education that needs to happen, how much change that needs to happen.
Yeah, you can see how it really is embedded in the way society works, even in people's language. Yeah, we have such a long way to go. And in a way, hopefully out of this very bleak, difficult, upsetting time, hopefully we will develop more of a culture of openness and move to a position of equality. And we can't just sort of sit here and wait for it to happen. People need to check themselves, check their white privilege, start to educate themselves, read, talk to people.
Have those difficult conversations.
Yeah. And hopefully, as time goes on, we will see a change. But we stand with our friends, colleagues, and everybody. And we are working really hard to fight our own internal racism as it comes up and to proactively be anti-racist.
Yep, we are here and we support you.
Now on to the interview with Professor Anthony Costello.
We hope you enjoy it.
Today, we're delighted to welcome Professor Anthony Costello as our guest on CoronaCast. He's Professor of Global Health and Sustainable Development at University College London and a former Director of Maternal and Child Health at the World Health Organization. He qualified as a doctor in 1978, specializing in pediatrics. He currently sits on the Independent SAGE Committee, which is an independent group of 12 eminent experts, which has been set up to provide robust, independent advice to the government and help navigate the COVID-19 pandemic. So welcome to the show, Anthony. Thank you so much for joining us.
Not at all.
So if we could start by talking about the Independent SAGE Committee that you set up. Obviously, the government has its own SAGE Committee. So why did you, Sir David King, and your colleagues decide to set this up?
Well, Sir David King really initiated this with the help of a group called the Citizens, who are really a group of journalists and media people who want to be more active in engaging with issues that are relevant to public and sharing of information. And Sir David King's a former government chief scientific advisor, as And he basically was concerned about the lack of transparency. You'll recall that, you know, even a month ago, we didn't know the members of SAGE. We didn't know what their documents were. We didn't know the minutes of their meeting.
No, no.
So everyone was saying we're following the science, but really Nobody knew what that science was. And that goes against kind of the principles of science, which is about debate, really.
Yeah. And in especially in management of an emergency, I understand that transparency is really, really important in order to manage a pandemic successfully.
I think so, because you have to take the public with you. And, you know, I was also concerned about the strategy, actually. I mean, from day one, if you go back to the March the 12th press conference, when they suddenly said they were moving from containment to delay.
Yeah, we don't need to test anyone anymore.
Exactly.
We can stop testing because we've accepted everybody's going to get it. For me, March the 12th was a really key date in what happened.
I was so shocked because everything that they were saying, I thought was wrong. Obviously, at WHO, although I'm not an ID epidemiologist or anything, I have been at WHO. I was there during the Zika virus outbreak and got quite heavily involved in all of that. I was in touch with the WHO people and they were really shocked. And in fact, the Director General Tedros put out a statement which wasn't, you know, formally directed at Britain, but was very definitely saying that if you, you know, move to delay and stop containment, that's really dangerous. And he said that at the time. So, yeah, that's why I got involved, because I felt that, you know, big mistakes were being made. And it was David King and Carol, who runs the Citizens, who got in touch. And then I helped them with getting the sort of names of people I thought would bring the public health dimension to it.
Yeah, because there weren't actually any, when we found out the membership of the SAGE committee, there, we found out that there weren't actually any epidemiologists on the committee, were there?
No, I mean, it is staggering that you don't have a public health practitioner on the committee, because that's what they do, is fight epidemics and control infection. And I mean, among other things, obviously, but so it was a bit of a shock. And they had very good people on SAGE, don't get me wrong. I mean, they had good modelers, they had virologists, they had behavioral scientists, but ultimately they didn't have doctors that specialized in public health. And to me, that was a terrible error.
When managing a public health crisis. Yeah,
exactly.
It would seem to be. Okay, so you set it up as a committee with a group of experts that had a different makeup from SAGE and that would make your findings publicly known.
Yeah, it's a different makeup in terms of there's lots more public health there, but we got some interesting people. I mean, so you've got public health people like Martin McKee, who's one of the top guys in the country, Gabriel Scally, who's advising the Irish government on how to tackle this and is a former big whiz in public health in the UK, and Alison Pollock, who's a very forceful public health specialist. What was really interesting was to get Carl Friston, who's the most cited neurobiologist in the world and specializes in mathematical modeling, but very different from epidemiological modeling.
Right.
He uses a different kind of modeling, which is looking forward and using much more variables and what's called Bayesian
networks.
Yeah, exactly. And he's been fascinating working with him. I mean, he's tipped to win the Nobel Prize. So, I mean, he's but he's very charming and very interesting. We've got Dinam Pillay, who's a virologist. We've got Kamlesh Kunti, who is a professor in Leicester, who was a GP but does an awful lot on non-communicable diseases and the like. Zubeda Haq, who I have met previously, who is she's the acting director of the Runnymede Trust that does a lot of work with Black and ethnic minorities, and she's extremely articulate and very, very good. And we've got other people, and I'm forgetting who they are.
they're all on the Independent SAGE website, so we can direct our listeners to there. But yeah, I mean, what a group of very eminent people, and sounds like a set of very safe hands for this pandemic to be in. Are you advising the government then?
Not formally, but we've often been described as a rival group, and we're not trying to be that. We're just trying to be a transparent group. We've done a couple of public consultations, and when we produce our reports, we've done two so far, and we'll bring another one out next week on test, trace and isolate. The idea is we send them to Sir Patrick Vallance and Chris Whitty, and we obviously have very good connections in the media, so we try and get our findings out.
Yeah.
Sir David King is in contact with Patrick Vallance, And one of our members knows Chris Whitty. And it's not to, you know, get into a fight particularly. It's to present evidence and from a slightly different perspective. And, you know, I don't think there's any harm in that to bring it. But we don't disagree with a lot of what they say. We've disagreed with some things. And I've no doubt they would disagree with some of us. But that's the way science and medicine progresses, isn't it?
Sure. And surely the more experts you have involved in this, the better. You say it's an independent group, and some of the decision making does appear to be a little bit politicized, I would say, in terms of what's going on. So it's kind of nice to know that there's an independent group advising too.
I mean, we were not set up as of any political persuasion. I don't know how other people on the panel would vote, and I would imagine I think we probably have cross-party representation. If you go back to some of the people in history who said, you know, medicine is political. I mean, health is about politics ultimately, and it's about issues around power and decision making, and you can't avoid that. Health is from all ministries, isn't it? I mean, economics, transport, environment, everything, education, everything affects health. And therefore, it is inherently political, I think.
Mm. Yeah, actually, that reminds me, I saw that you're very much involved with global health and climate change. And I read something you wrote about how initially you didn't think climate change was a health problem, but he quickly realized that it definitely was.
Well, it's interesting that, because that happened in 2007. I went to a meeting at the Royal College of Physicians, and I happened to sit next to Richard Horton, the editor of The Lancet, who I knew vaguely, not that well. And I was suddenly confronted with all this data. I was really shocked, and I realized that this was a terrible crisis, actually. And then he rang me up and said, look, you set up a new Institute for Global Health at UCL. I want a university to do a commission on this. And I said, I know nothing about climate change. He said, no, but you've got a university. Go and dig out everyone from the faculty. So I went around and met all the people from, you know, law, from geography, from philosophy, from maths, from everywhere. And what that taught me, actually, and I've stayed involved in that, you know, who's an expert? I mean, my expertise is in community health of mothers and children in poor countries.
Right.
What's that got to do with climate? Well, it's got a lot to do with climate, actually, because climate change affects everything. And so you need meteorologists, you need geographers, you need ecologists, you need lawyers. It's a multidimensional thing. And actually, COVID's exactly the same.
Yeah.
Just because you're a virologist doesn't mean that you're any good on what politically it means about COVID or about BME issues, or it's a pandemic. So it's got political, scientific, legal issues. So no one is an expert. You need a team. And I think that's what's interesting about the size of our team, because it's about 12 to 13 people. And we have very lively arguments, and we don't always agree, but we try to get to some kind of consensus position. And I think that's the way things should be done.
That is, like you say, that's what science is about, isn't it? It's about debating the issues, about disagreeing and then coming to a consensus. And it's really important that we have that at a time of significant uncertainty.
Definitely. And I mean, social media is really interesting, because I know it's a bit addictive and it ruins our lives and all that. But actually, from a scientific point of view, it's been phenomenal, I think, because firstly, when you write papers, unless you get them in top journals, only about 5 people ever read them. And 2 of those are parents. You know? So, I mean, so now whenever we publish anything, I'll put the abstract out onto social media. And also on social media, you get fantastic access to people. For example, in COVID, I've now started following the world's leading people on various issues, and you read their threads and stuff, and then you put your own threads up, and then you get critical feedback, and you get, you know, you get the odd troll, but I don't worry too much about that.
No.
But it's fascinating, because you can pick up so many ideas, and I think you move forward much more quickly.
Yeah, it's actually a brilliant way of bringing people together and allowing them to interact in real time. Like you've said in the past, we need to be acting fast here, and it facilitates you doing that.
Yeah.
Which is brilliant.
Yes, I mean, I think just on that point, you raise very important about speed and acting fast.
Yeah.
And one of the things that WHO emphasized, both Mike Ryan, who runs the emergencies team, and Tedros, the director general, was, you know, you've got to find the virus. And they said, you've got to find it through, you know, find it, symptoms, test if you can, track people, isolate them, socially distance, but do it all at speed.
Yeah.
And don't let perfect be the enemy of the good. Just get in there.
Get it done.
Yeah. And you see, that's what Korea did, South Korea, because they were kind of pre-immunized because they had SARS-1
yeah.
in 2002. And then they had MERS in 2015. So they were really scared. And they had a system that meant they set up testing very quickly. And because they moved in fast, they got it on under control very quickly.
They took a lot of other public health measures at the same time, didn't they? Because, again, tried and tested.
Exactly. They didn't actually lock down. They did partial lockdowns in two of their provinces. But Greece was the other one that did very well because they knew they had a problem. They knew they couldn't really test that much. So they went into lockdown when they just had a few cases and no deaths. And they've ended up with 150 deaths and Korea 250. But because we delayed, we hit the exponential part of the curve and everything soared upwards.
Time was of the essence, wasn't it? And there was that delay in locking down over those for two weeks, I think it was, which cost a lot of lives.
Well, the estimate was that round about the 12th of March, when they decided to stop, we probably had about 10,000 cases. And by the end of March, the Imperial Group estimate we went up to 1.8 million cases. That's how quickly.
That's exponential in action, isn't it? Gosh.
It is. It's exactly. And it's really terrifying. And I think this has been very traumatic for us as a country. And I think, you know, we're going to have other pandemics. You probably, I don't think you're old enough, Hannah, but I remember the 80s. And I remember I did a locum at the Royal Free Hospital in 1981.
Right.
I was an SHO in chest medicine. And we went round and then my registrar said, okay, let's go to the ITU. We've got a young man on the ITU. And we went in and he had a whiteout on both of his lungs in x-ray. And they said, oh, he's grown this strange bug called pneumocystis. He's got some kind of immune deficiency. And sure enough, he was then written up and he was the first case that they wrote up of AIDS in the UK. And of course, that was 4 years before they identified the HIV, you know, as the cause.
So you worked through all that time.
Yeah, I mean, I'd assumed at that time, everyone thought that infectious diseases were over, you know, because of antibiotics. And so we've had HIV. And then within 2 weeks of me starting at WHO about 5 or 6 years ago, we had, you know, Zika virus.
Yeah.
A disease, actually a virus I'd never heard of. And a week later, I was having to speak as the world expert on world, you know, BBC World Service.
Oh, gosh.
I mean, I'm not the world expert. And I'm back to the point that there is no such thing as the world expert. You're all experts in different things. But when I was at UCL before going to WHO, I decided to set up some video interviews with people. I interviewed Robin Weiss, who was the virologist at UCL and before that, the Cancer Institute. And he was an expert on all these viruses. In fact, he was the first person to develop a test for HIV and also was a co-discoverer of the CD4 antigen, which is the target for HIV. Anyway, a very smart guy. And at the end of my 10-minute interview, I said, well, what about emerging viruses? And he said, well, it's going to hit us. He said, we've been very lucky so far because SARS-1, he said, was, you know, and MERS were too virulent because they were killing their patients too easily. They died out. And he said, but we're going to get others. And I remember telling the student in October when they came in, the master's student, saying, listen, you're going to hit new viruses and new, you never know when it's going to come along. And of course, you know, 3 months later, we're in the worst pandemic for a century.
Sure enough. Yeah. And it's a very clever virus indeed, because it doesn't kill all of its hosts. There's a long period of pre-symptomatic spread. And
it is very clever. Yeah.
Yeah. So just going on to some of the nitty gritty then, wouldn't mind talking a bit about this easing of lockdown that we're seeing this week. because I know Independent Sage has reported on whether the 1st of June is the right time to send schools back and concluded that no, it's too early. And even waiting 2 weeks would make a big difference. But, you know, schools have started to go back this week, haven't they? Can you tell us a bit more about that and your work there?
There can't be an absolute date because everywhere in the country is slightly different, a different part of the epidemic, because in a sense, it's a whole series of epidemics. You know, it started in London, moved to the Midlands, and it's rippled out to cities and then more smaller rural areas as it's gone. And so we said, well, look, you've got to have a number of conditions. First, you want to have a protective shield in your community. So you want to have your find, test, trace and isolate scheme set up. Secondly, you need to know about how many infections there are in your community, because that's pretty vital to know. If there's still quite a lot around, it's not going to be so safe. Thirdly, you need to have the head teachers and parents happy to go back. Now, clearly, you know, you want kids to go back to school, but we weren't convinced that find, test, trace and isolate was going to be up and running, and we're still not. I mean, that's pretty evident that it isn't.
No, it's pretty patchy.
But also, our clever modeller, Carl Friston, looked at various factors and tried to quantify the risk. And he said, well, what's the risk of a child being exposed to coronavirus in their school? Using national figures on average, mm-hmm. What's the risk of becoming infected and what's the risk of dying? Those are the principal things that you're concerned about. And he worked out that if you went on average across the country, if you went back on Monday, your risk of exposure was about 1 in 25. Risk of catching the infection was about 1 in 50. And the risk of dying is incredibly low. You know, it's about the same as having a fatal road traffic accident. It was a bit more and it goes, but all of those risks halve over the next 2 weeks because we're on the downward curve. And also 2 weeks would give a chance to the find, track, trace and isolate campaign to get a bit, you know, embedded in. Those two reasons. But we said there may be parts of the country where it's very low, where people are pretty happy with what's going on and they can go back to school.
Yeah, that takes me on to something else that struck me, which is how we're not making enough use of local healthcare networks that are already set up in this. So as a GP, I've noticed that GP practices haven't particularly been involved in managing this pandemic when we are there, very quiet, you know, patients staying away, kind of twiddling our thumbs. We would have loved to get involved with helping to manage the pandemic, but it's all been very managed, you know, it's been centralized. You know, this needs to be looked at on a local level.
Let me be very honest. I'll be very frank with you. I'm appalled at what's gone on. That's my personal opinion. I'm not representing Sage yet, but I'm going to try and influence a bit. Because, look, most of my work overseas has been in, you know, Nepal, Bangladesh, India, Malawi, and I got involved in a lot of community engagement programs. And we did 12 cluster randomized trials showing that if you mobilize communities, you can, you know, get huge impacts, even though local health services are pretty weak. In fact, I wrote a book actually published 2 years ago called The Social Edge, and it's all about how what I call sympathy groups, which are, you know, the next size of group up from your family, which is usually about 15 people, come together. And we've always done that as human beings, you know, whether it's hunting groups, gathering groups, farming groups, credit groups, theater groups, you know, choirs, funeral groups. Every culture has the small group as very pivotal. And even in science, it's like that. You know, you have to work in a group, not as one person. And to come back and see such a centralized thing, but worse, you see, I don't think this find, test, track, isolate campaign they've come up with can possibly work. I'll be very blunt.
Right. Why not?
Because you need speed and you need trust. And I think it's shocking the way GPs are the center of our NHS. 90% of people belong. GPs, I would invert it and say GPs are the best doctors. Consultants are kind of specialists who stick tubes up you. And, you know, paediatrics is sort of a bit of a cross between general practice and because you're doing, you know, everything. And I would have started completely the opposite. I would have said, how many GPs have we got in this country? 61,000. How many practices have we got? 7,200. How many primary care networks? Probably about 1,800. Right, that's 30,000. All the GPs know one another. They're highly trained. They're professional. Right, let's set up a hub in every primary care network to start. 1,800 hubs. That's very doable. Let's have a hot place there that you have nurses who can collect nasal swabs. I mean, you do. Every time I have a problem, I go to the GP. He does the blood test and the stuff there.
Yeah.
And you get the results back in about a day.
Yeah.
Telling me that you can't have a nasal swab done. Well, obviously, initially, they didn't want to have everyone coming into a surgery. But if you start, you know, one surgery in four, where you knew in your locality you could go to get a nasal swab, you can get it sent off to one of the NHS labs, you get the result back in a day, and then you've got the person who's A, going to reassure you, who's going to monitor your symptoms.
Who knows your comorbidities.
Knows all the comorbidities, knows all your close contacts, because they're probably the same practice.
Yeah, yeah.
What are we messing around at? And yet they've now got these people trained for 4 hours sitting in call centres being paid to do nothing. And even worse, you've got a dual test system whereby Deloitte are running these things in car parks where the results are either not sent back for a week or they don't come through to the GPs.
Yeah.
I think the whole thing is crazy.
Yeah, we're not receiving the test results.
And I'm slightly appalled that the GPs and public health didn't get a grip on this quicker. I blame public health. I mean, public health has been totally run down. And I hadn't realized this in this country because I've been abroad. And since 2013, they've split it up. Were you aware that the Public Health England has no control or links to public health in districts?
No, I was not aware of that.
Well, I'll tell you, Public Health England is set up and it has 300 staff.
Right.
And they run health protection teams in regions. Mm-hmm. But all the public health officers are on local authorities. And so they're not even employed by the NHS. And the links between them and PHE are you know, pretty... what's the word? Derisory. I mean, they do have some links and they do, but you know, we've weakened the whole public health system. Whereas even 10 years ago, you had regional public health advisors like Gabriel Scally, who's been telling me about it, saying who had absolute control over their area. And as soon as they would mobilize and they were part of the NHS,
right.
I mean, public health has been taken out of the NHS. And of course, it's local authorities who've suffered most from austerity because they've had their budgets halved.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're not fit for purpose.
That's where we've really scrimped in the last sort of 10 years, isn't it?
Absolutely. And we've bypassed, you know, primary care. And I think, I have to say this, I think it's ideological. I think there are people, I don't know quite who to blame, but I think Matt Hancock must take some of it. I mean, Serco does not have a good track record.
No.
It was fined for fraud. It's been fined for poor performance. It's got links to the Tory party, as has Deloitte and the rest of them. I mean, it smacks of crony capitalism.
Cronyism, yeah, absolutely.
The minister that I heard on the radio this morning, Edward Auger, I just looked him up because I was interested, and he was a head of public relations at Serco.
Right.
Conflict of interest.
Yeah, hugely. How can they justify that? Although, you know, it doesn't really surprise me on the other hand.
Well, the other thing I would have done would be, if you've got your 1,800 hubs, I would have said, right, stick three contact tracers into each one to start with,
yeah,
and then recruit more from the 750,000 volunteers. And I bet you 50,000 of them are retired doctors or nurses. And I bet you if you had in every 30,000, there'd be a lot of retired doctors that would happily come and help.
Yeah, we had all those volunteers.
Either as volunteers or... Yeah, and I mean, we could have done this. And then you know your local locality, you know everyone. Everyone feels trusted. Do you think people are going to trust being rung up and told to isolate for 14 days with no follow-up?
By someone in a call centre. I know. It's just not been thought through. It's this, you know, using the networks that were already there would make so much sense. It seems such a shame.
Well, it's a bit like creating a mercenary army instead of using your proper army if you're in a war. And given that we are kind of, because infections cause many more casualties than warfare. I mean, the Spanish flu of 1918-19 killed a lot more than died in the First World War.
Yeah.
And malaria has killed millions of people. And that's why the US military has spent so much money on malaria, because they know it's a big risk, you know.
Yeah, they use the healthcare army that you've already got. Well, thank you for that.
We've got the best primary care system in the world, actually. I mean, you can't say everything is world-beating, but I've had two GPs, right, since I've lived in my house for 30 years.
Mm.
Both have been tip-top, in my view. And I adore them, a woman, and then I've got a man now who is, you know, very evidence-based. And actually, I do a lot of it by email. I don't know if you're doing much more on email and...
Yeah, we have been. It's actually taught us new ways of working, which are in lots of ways much more efficient. Yeah, so we can do email. People can email pictures of their rashes. We can do video consultations, and it actually takes up a lot less time, and it is obviously a lot better in terms of infection control when you've got a virus going around.
And I don't think you'll go back completely to how you were before, will you?
No, the managing partner of my practice has been saying you were definitely going to maintain some of these changes. You know, it's been nice working from home a couple of days a week as well. You know, save the petrol, save the environment a bit. So yeah, I think lots of these changes will stick. And that'll be a really good thing.
You know, GPs bring a holistic view to things. They put the specifics of diagnosis in the social context. They're aware of, you know, limitations, vulnerabilities. You know, that's the beauty of general practice. And, you know, that's why I put GPs actually on a higher level than a lot of people who are just catheter pushers, if you like.
Sure. Catheter pushers.
And that's actually why I liked pediatrics, because, you know, it touched on everything from neonatal intensive care, which is where I started, to kind of community mobilization around improving maternal and child health. The generalist approach is very important.
Yeah, it really is. I think I agree. And medicine has become very much specialist and subspecialist, and we lose that some of that holisticness, don't we? Well, one sort of bugbear of mine has been, and I just wonder what your thoughts are on this, about the viral PCR swab that we do for coronavirus. The accuracy of that test is only around 70% sensitive. So it means that 3 out of 10 people who should test positive for virus test negative. There's not been much transparency about the fact that this is the case. I've known healthcare staff who have symptoms of the virus and have a swab, they test negative and they are sent back to work. And patients are told that they can go back to work when they have a negative swab, even if they have symptoms, like even the cardinal symptoms. Do you think this is having an impact on spread of the disease or has had an impact? And why do you think there is an openness about that?
That's a really good question. And I agree with you. Many of the Asian states, when they started out, did not have that much testing capacity. So they said, look, have you got the cardinal symptoms? And if there's any doubt, you stay at home and we'll monitor you. And then they would, you know, let them go if it was very clear. And that's why I wanted it with local GPs who can make some of these assessments. That's what you're trying to do. People say, oh, well, the symptoms are not very specific. But, you know, if you come to me and say, oh, I've got a fever and a dry cough and I'm feeling lousy, and this was a month ago, you'd say, well, it sounds very much like you've got COVID.
Yeah, for me as a clinician working with, you know, assessing patients on the phone and in this hot clinic I work at, it's obvious when a patient has the virus from the history that they tell you and the symptoms that they have.
Exactly. And stay at home. And also the other thing, in Korea and China, they did a lot of second tests on people. They didn't just believe a negative result because they were aware of the, you know, imperfections of testing. In fact, early on in the incubation period, it's even lower than 70%. I think it's down at sort of 20, 30, and then it comes up. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it starts to go down again. So it's like a a curve anyway. You can get a negative test, you need to retest. But I think there's been an obsession in this country on numbers of tests without thinking about what we're trying to do. You want to isolate the case and you want to isolate their contact. And yet we haven't done that very well, and we haven't monitored it. And the current system doesn't seem to do that. Just telling people to go and do things doesn't always work.
No. And we seem moving on to the R0 number, or the R0 number, which is about the admission of cases. And you know, the government policy now apparently is very reliant on that R number and sort of directed by that. And we've had one of our listeners, Melanie, asked us a question about the R number, actually wondering how it's calculated. And as far as I have found out, in order for the R number to be accurate, you need your testing levels to be very high. And also it's based on quite historic data. So having a current R number is quite difficult to ascertain. Can you talk to us a bit about that?
Well, I'm not an expert, but I agree with you. Firstly, when you get an R number, however it's calculated, I mean, ideally, you want to go and find cases and find exactly how many contacts go on to get it. Because they can't always do that, the epidemiologists use different ways of calculating it with various clever methods, and I think there are different ones. But whatever they do, they end up with an estimate which is based about 15, 16 days before. So it's not an absolutely contemporary thing, and things can change quite fast. Either it's going down or it's going up. So we don't really know what the R is at the moment, and it could actually be over one. You know, if you could know what it was exactly today. And it's for that reason that Carl Friston said, well, look, he said our values, they're not an intrinsic biological measure. They change all the time. They're just telling you how your virus is progressing in that population. So he looks to the future, and he uses a different kind of modeling that asks questions and then projects what may happen.
Right.
The only interesting thing about this, and I'm going to switch a bit from R, but the big issue is, do you build immunity? Now, originally, the government said, we want to build herd immunity. And I thought that was wrong for all kinds of reasons. Let's not go into that.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's say they're right. Now, they said at the time, we want 60% of you to get it, and you'll build herd immunity, but there is a 1% mortality rate. So I worked that out, and that's 400,000 deaths.
I worked that out at the whenever it was, in March, and was like, oh, you know, we do not have the intensive care capacity.
And then they said, well, they panicked a few days later when they realized they would be overrun. So that's when they said, oh, we've got to jump on it more quickly.
Mm.
But the issue is, so at the moment, it's thought that around less than 10% of our population have antibodies. And that's the marker of the immune response at, say, a month after infection.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to head up towards 70,000 deaths. I mean, they say it's 40,000 now. But in fact, the Financial Times estimate, if you add in the care homes and the community, we're at about 64,000.
Yeah.
All right, let's say 65,000 and 10%. Well, if you want to get to 60%, multiply by six, that's 420,000. So in a sense, the government projection from the beginning was right. But it's a disaster, because you obviously don't want that. And at the time, they didn't talk about suppression at a time when China and Korea and, you know, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Japan had already suppressed their epidemic. Now, they would turn around and say, well, this is a long haul and they're all going to get it eventually because this is a pandemic.
They can't shut themselves away forever.
No, but the answer to that is yes, but viruses mutate. And the way to get herd immunity is a vaccine.
So it buys you time.
Yeah. One interesting thing, though, is some people are saying now, but maybe you don't need 60% herd immunity. Or maybe the antibodies don't represent all aspects of immunity. Virologists and immunologists generally get very upset at that stage and say you're talking rubbish. But there is some evidence coming out of some top labs that there is quite a lot of T cell responsiveness to the current COVID, even in people who had blood taken a year ago.
Ah, okay.
And so it's possible Children, for example, may prime their T cells without getting much in the way of antibodies that is detected, but actually they're going to be fine. You know, so I sort of am being a bit convinced by some of these people, but not really, because I think if only 10% of us have had it, and the virus is still circulating, we're definitely going to have outbreaks.
Yeah, but it's funny at the moment, isn't it? Because numbers have gone very, very low. There are very few people now, I believe, in intensive care units with COVID. Okay, this might be explained by the fact that we've had this lockdown. And so we're kind of lulled into a false sense of security. But, you know, for example, on VE Day, which was almost a month ago, there were all those parties. We haven't really seen a spike in cases following on from that. Is it because those parties were mainly outside?
If you look at all the regions last week, there was an uptick in all of the regions. It wasn't huge, but there was an uptick, and it was thought to be linked a bit to VE Day. Now, I think the last week has been much more lifting the lockdown. I mean, I'm in Yorkshire, where I walk on the cliffs and see no one, but in the last week has been beaches packed.
The weekend was like there'd never been a virus.
So I would be getting worried about what's going to happen in a couple of weeks' time.
Right, okay.
It's going to take a couple of weeks before we see an uptick in infections, and maybe another week after that or 2 weeks that you start to see the impact on deaths.
Yeah.
But it may be that it doesn't, that because we're still social distancing by and large. What Carl Friston says is he expects there may be small localized outbreaks, but not a big surge or anything until maybe after Christmas, when he thinks that may be a time when immunity is fading a bit in those that have had it and the winter months are more conducive to it. That's his theory. A lot of people disagree. So I think there's quite a debate going on at the moment between epidemiologists and virologists about what is actually going to happen in future.
Yeah, there are so many possibilities at the moment, aren't there? And then, because there's this other, you know, so there's the theory you mentioned about herd immunity somehow being achieved at a lot lower level, like 17 to 25% rather than 60% for some reason. And I read an article about postulating that. And there's this other theory that somebody reported from Italy that the virus seemed to be dying away.
Yeah, I saw that. Dr. Grazinelli from Milan or somewhere. No, Lombardy.
Yeah.
To be fair, I mean, he said this, but I mean, he's not a lab person or an epidemiologist. And I think we have to be a bit careful. And you see, you would expect, you know, epidemics do go in this kind of curve with a long tail. Mm. And it's because it's interacting with us as a population. We're adjusting to it and changing our behavior and stuff. But I would not rule out a second surge at some stage. I don't think it would be as high as the first one. But I do think we'll get localized outbreaks because they've had them in China, in Japan, in Germany, in most places, actually, where they have, you know, lifted the lockdown. But you're right. I mean, in London, we are probably up at about 17% of immunity. And New York, of course, is saying it's up at
about the same. Yeah, and Stockholm is 20% apparently as well.
So it's possible. We just don't know. I still worry that the idea that you get herd immunity at 20%, unless you have some kind of hidden immunity we don't understand, that's T cells and not antibodies and stuff. But I talk to virologists and they laugh at me, you know.
Yeah.
Sorry, is that Tilly there?
Yeah, that's me.
Did you want to say anything, Tilly?
It's going back a bit. The R number and the testing and stuff. I found quite worrying just because my dad tested positive for coronavirus because he's a key worker. He works at Parliament. It seemed kind of clear that they just wanted to rush him straight out as quickly as possible. He got a text saying it was positive and saying you can go back to work on day 8 if you still got a cough. He doesn't have any problems, but he's kind of mid-50s, male, overweight. It just surprised me, I guess, how kind of rapidly they wanted to kind of get him back out and be done with it, if you know what I mean.
I mean, that's why GPs are important, because you want somebody to look after you and advise you and reassure you and talk to you about it. But yeah, I mean, the other thing is, 7 days, they say, to isolate. Actually, WHO say 14.
Yeah, that was what, yeah.
It's true that most virus has disappeared, or live virus, by about 7 days, but not entirely. And there are people that, you know, carry on, you know, if they're coughing and stuff, they may be infecting others a bit longer. So, you know, in Northern Ireland, on the border, there are towns where there's some in the Southern Ireland, which follow the European rules, which is 14 days. And in the other part, the Northern Irish bit, it's 7 days, which is a bit crazy.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Yeah, it'd be good to have some consistency.
How is he, by the way? Is he all right now?
Yeah, he's actually got over it quite well, pretty quickly. I mean, I'm hoping he doesn't get ill with it again, because I know there's been some cases where people have been okay for like a few weeks, and then, like, very rarely, but it's happened, and then been, and then got ill again, which again is why I'm like a bit odd that it's 7 days, or day eight, you can go back. But he's okay at the moment, and he seems to have recovered pretty well. So that's good.
Well, I've got a question for you guys. You know, initially we were told the vast majority, 80% of people would get a very mild illness. And that's not my reading of it. I think that a lot of people that stayed at home had really a horrible illness. You know, the people I've known, Paul Garner, who I knew and wrote articles in the BMJ and the Guardian, I think, who's a professor at Liverpool, he said he's been feeling lousy and weird for 8 weeks.
Yeah, I've read that.
I know another woman who has had it. You know, it's now been well over a month and she's still not right. And as a GP, are you seeing that? Do you think 80% of trivial illness, or it's not?
I mean, it depends how you define mild illness, I suppose. But it's made people feel pretty sick. You know, a lot of people for days, and with this really interesting sort of, I've been calling it a relapsing and remitting course, where they have the symptoms and then they can be well for 1 week or 2 weeks, and then the symptoms hit them again. That what those patients describe a lot is the lethargy, being so, so tired, and they can sleep for hours, and they have no energy, and even like a small amount of activity makes them have to lie down. And the symptoms that come back that seem to be the symptoms that they had at the beginning. So they can have the cough, and then the cough completely goes for a couple of weeks, and then it comes back with a vengeance. I know someone who's had symptoms for 11 weeks now. And it'll be interesting when we know more about why the virus is causing this course.
Yes, and also longer term sequelae of this.
Yeah.
I mean, it worries me a little bit that some children have, you know, raised cardiac enzymes. Mm. What's the long term impact? It worries me that we could see a lot of chronic fatigue syndrome after this.
Yeah.
Because there is an immune, you know, that's how this virus clobbers you in the second week. It's the immune response. And presumably that in these long-term people, you've jiggered up your immune response in some way, and it may last a long time. I don't know.
Yeah, this sort of severe post-viral syndrome, as it were. And also, as well, of course, there's the, you know, long-term lung damage that people might have if they've had, you know, little tiny blood clots in their lungs. So that's also quite worrying.
Yeah.
I guess we're not going to know about those sequelae until we get into the coming years.
Yeah.
I just wanted to talk a bit, if you don't mind, Anthony, about the Public Health England report that was published yesterday. So a completely different subject.
The
Black and Minority Ethnic COVID Risk Report that was published yesterday had been eagerly awaited because Black and Minority Ethnic people disproportionately affected by COVID-19. The report yesterday has been slightly disappointing, hasn't it?
Yeah, as somebody said to me, if that was a master's thesis, you'd probably fail them, because it was badly presented and there were no recommendations and it was just a list of tables and it wasn't very laid out very well. It wasn't even written very well. However, I read that it was sent in to the ministry and that it didn't survive Matt Hancock's office and that they edited it hugely. And I think they took out all the actions and recommendations. So it looks like, to me, a report that was heavily censored.
Yeah, there was a section about structural and institutional racism.
Exactly.
And about how this disproportion was related to sort of discrimination and poorer life chances. And that section was completely removed.
Exactly. And so, in a sense, it is very disappointing. It didn't really tell us as much we didn't know already.
No.
But of course, it didn't get into some of the other issues, why Black and minority ethnic groups have suffered, and touching on some of the social elements. Obviously, many will live in more deprived areas and will have more risk factors from illnesses. But there are other factors as well around, you know, institutional racism and all kinds of things. Mm. So, and I think they should touch on that. And of course, you need policies to deal with each of those. Deprivation has soared with inequalities, which has not really been addressed. I mean, to be fair to the government, the furlough scheme and the rest has put some protective, shield around a lot of people, but there are still an awful lot of poor people who are very vulnerable. Then there's the whole issue. Certainly diabetes is an issue. I mean, we've done work in Bangladesh on diabetes, and a third of people over the age of 30 in Bangladesh have pre-diabetes or diabetes.
Gosh, didn't realize it was as high as that.
Institutional racism is still there in many parts. I mean, I think things have improved. And, you know, certainly in medicine, I think there's more opportunities. And, you know, what's been very revealing is our health service is so dependent upon migrant groups or second generation. And they were in the front line.
Yeah, it's been tragic to see that.
Well, the second half of the report will be coming out. So I think we ought to wait until we see what it says.
I just feel like it's been so hush-hush, though, in a way, this whole data with BAME groups being, was it twice as likely to die? Like, I was on Facebook kind of scrolling through, and people were posting articles saying breaking news, like BAME people twice more likely to die. And I was so shocked, because that is not breaking news. That has been around for a long time, that information, but no one seems to want to do anything with it. And then with the report yesterday, it just seems like it's trying to be kept so sort of hush hush and not faced up to.
There seems a reticence to talk about it, you know, and especially now in the wake of the tragic death of George Floyd in America, in police custody, there's a sharp focus on racism against Black people now more than ever. And we need to have these conversations and start looking into the reasons behind these inequalities.
Absolutely. And my children, the two of them are on the march at the moment somewhere. I don't know if it's still going on. And it's good. I'm very proud of them because they take it very seriously. I think people in London especially have been brought up in very multi-ethnic schools and all the rest are extremely sensitive to this and very angry about what's going on.
Yeah.
And I, you know, share those views. I think it's very important to stand up for those principles. And we've got a long way to go. I think, you know, this country, I think, doesn't have as bad a scenario, if you like, as in the United States.
Mm.
And there has been more mixing and stuff. But there are, you know, issues always with minorities, whether they're white, Jewish, Black, Asian, you know, wherever. And we have to think about it hard and maintain harmony.
Yeah, and talk about it and not be afraid to.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I wanted to sort of go on to one final area, really, and just ask you, if you were in charge, what would you do?
You know, the consequences of a liquidity crisis becoming a bankruptcy crisis, a mass unemployment. I think we are teetering on the edge, not just of a recession, but of a depression, because many businesses could go under in the next few months. So I think we have to be very cautious here. And that's why find, test, trace, isolate is so important. And I would completely transform that if I was prime minister. I would do it in a different way. And I link it very closely to GPs and local public health and communities so that they can get ownership of this. And then we have to see where we go. And to some extent, that will also depend upon the immune aspects and this virus. But we may have to live with it for a long time. We probably won't have a vaccine until, you know, middle of next year, probably at the earliest. And it might even be longer than that, unless we're very lucky. We might get a partial vaccine, but and that might be good enough, actually, to reduce death rates and the like. So let's wait and see. It is a little bit uncertain, the future.
Yeah, the next month or so will tell us a lot. Yeah.
If we don't see much happening in the next 6 weeks, then we may be able to get things moving again. But my fear is that we'll go back to what we think is normal again, and then, you know, everything will blow up again, which is quite possible.
Yeah, and that's why we need to reinforce the public health messages. I know that Independent Sage were approached by the opposition leaders in Westminster about Dominic Cummings and what happened and what he did, and whether Independent Sage thinks that is going to impact public health.
We didn't have much to offer in terms of quantifying the impact. Clearly, he broke the rules. You know, that was an issue. And whether there is a knock-on effect, and I think there probably has been, hopefully some of the behavioural science might show some of that, an uptick in various indicators or a downtick of behaviour and stuff. But I don't think we felt we could add much value to that. We didn't discuss it at length.
Okay, well, thank you, Anthony. That's been a brilliant conversation. We've really enjoyed it. It's been so enlightening and interesting. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Bye, Tilly. Good luck.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll be in touch. Okay, bye. Thank you so much to Professor Anthony Costello for that brilliant interview.
Yeah, that was a really important interview for our podcast.
It really was. We've really, really been wanting to talk to a public health expert, and it was so illuminating, the points he was raising, especially about the government's handling of the crisis. The failings that we've seen in the management has cost thousands of lives. The delay in lockdown, the lack of testing, and in fact deciding not to test people, failure to set up track and trace, which is still not set up, failure to address the terrible situation with Black, Asian and minority ethnic people being more susceptible to the virus. We still don't really know why that is. Failure to protect NHS staff with sufficient PPE. There's been a catalogue of failings, and we don't want to moan about management of this, but, you know, we need to look at what the issues have been in order that we can put them right. And the government needs to be held to account. And it's really good to hear that a committee like Independent Sage, headed up by Sir David King and Professor Anthony Costello and their colleagues, they are looking at the management, looking at what could be done better, how we should move forward, and holding the government to account. And that is just so important.
Yeah, like being open about it. And when I hear the number of deaths, like, it still astounds me. Like 65,000 people, that is so many deaths.
Yeah, now it's around 70,000 excess deaths.
And comparing it to like other countries, it's awful.
I really do think it's because of this very inward-looking approach that's been taken by the government rather than outward-looking. You know, we need a panel of experts. We need experts in all manner of different areas in order to manage this properly. And instead, the government has done it in a very top-down, centralised way, which hasn't been inclusive and open and transparent. And I think that is what has cost lives.
So it is very, very difficult to lead the country through it. And I can totally see that there are things that could have been done better, 100%. And also, I think with something like this, when it's something you don't know about and something that's kind of happening for the first time with this virus in this sense, you need to constantly be reviewing what you've done, constantly be looking at, okay, maybe that actually caused this, so we need to kind of change this. Like, that's what you would do in any situation with a new thing that you're not really sure about, that you're going through. You need to review what you're doing and see if it's working. And I don't feel like that's been happening.
No, we have been crying out. Experts have been crying out at every point about the shortcomings and what's going wrong. But it doesn't seem like the government is reviewing its own process. You're absolutely right there. And also, you know, it is an unprecedented situation, but there have been crises in the past, and there are MPs sitting in the House of Commons who have managed these crises and learn how to manage the public, engage with the public and handle the pressures. And the government could look to those people with all that experience. We have a very inexperienced cabinet at the moment, quite immature politicians, to be quite honest. And there are lots of very much more experienced politicians out there who could have really helped if only the attitude had been outward looking and embracing rather than this inward looking, self-seeking, this use of private companies in order to roll out testing, companies with no track record, sometimes poor track records, certainly no record of testing. And we had all of this infrastructure there in our primary care networks and our GPs that could have been used. And, you know, it is corrupt. Basically, the government has paid money to private companies with which ministers have personal links. That is corruption. And we need to stamp that out. And I hope that this raises awareness with our listeners and with the public. And I think people need to be talking about this more.
They haven't done very well and they need to be held accountable. Like, that point was so important, raised by Antti Costello, about GPs and how they could have been utilised. It's such a shame that wasn't the case and these private companies have been used. And it makes me really hopeless.
You know, we just want MPs and the cabinet ministers that come to the daily briefing to just hold their hands up sometimes in response to these questions and say, yeah, we're sorry, we made a mistake there, but we're going to work to put it right. That will be reassuring. That would make people feel better.
Yeah.
But they're just refusing to do that. They just have this bullish attitude.
Even though it's cost lives, they're still refusing to do that.
Yeah, it's frightening. And furthermore, it now looks like we're kind of sleepwalking into a no-deal Brexit under the cover of this crisis.
Mm.
Bills are being pushed through that aren't being scrutinised properly. It's terrifying.
We need to watch. You need to pay close attention. Do your reading. Keep in the loop with what's happening.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I feel a little bit like the wool's being pulled over our eyes.
Yeah. And we are going to become a very isolated little island if we are aligning ourselves with Trump and the US and pulling ourselves away from Europe. It's a very scary time.
But at least we have independent sage and someone like Professor Antti Costello working with the government in a sense, advising them, pulling up information.
Yeah, giving really, really good advice. And I really hope the government starts to listen.
Yeah, me too.
So, Antti, thank you so much for being a guest on CoronaCast. It was an absolute honour. Thank you for raising all those issues, discussing them with us. I think it was a really, really useful conversation, and I hope our listeners think so too. So now on to our positive news. Tilly, what's yours?
Okay, so on Monday, it was my gran's 70th birthday. So we went to her garden to celebrate with her, and she was meant to have a big party because it's obviously a big birthday, but she couldn't because of the coronavirus. So we got her a present where we basically emailed loads of her friends and our family who are really close to her and got them to kind of send in a video, a little clip of them saying happy birthday, maybe saying what they love about her, their favorite memory, or even some people did poems. And we put that together and gave it to her on her birthday, and it was so nice to see her watch it. She loved it so much. She's such a great person, and it really made her see that and feel appreciated, I think. So yeah, that was a really, really nice moment of the week for me.
Yeah, it was amazing to see her after all of these weeks, and it was just such a lovely day. Happy birthday, Mum. My positive news is that, well, I just wanted to say, you know, this is such a difficult time for people at the moment. There's a lot of civil unrest, and there's a lot of people not feeling very good. So I just want to encourage people to be kind to themselves and each other, you know, reach out to each other. If you're struggling, seek professional help, see your GP, and, you know, try and do things that make you happy, like exercising, if that's what you enjoy. For me, I am just going back to my runner beans. I'm really enjoying my runner beans. They're starting to grow up the poles that I've put in the garden, and I'm really excited for us to soon have some runner beans to eat.
Yep. If you actually want to get in touch with CoronaCast about anything, or questions, comments, whatever you want, our email is questions@coronacast.co.uk,
and our Twitter and Instagram handles are @thecoronacast. So yeah, please do get in touch, or if there's anyone you would like us to talk to on the podcast, we will be happy to follow that up. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. It's been a joy.
Thanks so much for listening.
Thank you. Do get in touch.
Yeah, bye.
This episode was lovingly produced by documentary filmmaker and photographer Harry Winteringham. Check out his work at harrywinteringham.uk. We'll post a link in the podcast description.